The first thing that you have to do when you get the energy that's collected by the radio telescope is you need to amplify it. You need to recognize it and amplify it with what we call low noise feeds and receivers. And these the equipment that we're using here is homegrown in Australia. It's been developed for us by CSIRO, and it's extremely unique. It's very wideband in its frequency capability. This is basically a feed horn. It looks down at the telescope. This is all mounted up here in the aerial cabin at Parkes. All of this plumbing actually looks down at the telescope so it can collect the radio waves that are focused up by the telescope. This has a very wideband coverage. This piece of pipe or plumbing is called an orthomode transducer. It allows us to simultaneously collect both senses of circular polarization in the electromagnetic wave. And on the top of this OMT, we clamp it into a cryogenic package, a cooled refrigerator, and we use very low noise amplifying devices, HEMT amplifiers, to cover the frequency range from 1 to 3 gigahertz continuously. And this is a unique piece of gear that hasn't been available to radio astronomy before, and we certainly have had a significant interest from the radio astronomy community to make use of it for projects other than SETI. So the front-end devices were built here in Australia, but all the digital signal processing gear is stuff that we brought from California. Now, to split up the wide radio spectrum into many tens of millions of narrow band channels, as such as we do, need to do Fourier transforms very fast. 5 years ago, we certainly couldn't get anything commercially that allowed us to work at that rate, the rate we needed to, because we do all our signal processing in real time and throw away the data if it doesn't contain interesting signals. So we did our own VLSI chip development, 1 micron CMOS. These chips get placed on boards, which I think you will agree are a bit dense. And these boards actually grow to 19 layers in the complexity. Boards get placed into standard equipment racks. Here standing in the lab are four racks. This is the multi-channel spectrum analyzer. It splits the frequency spectrum up. This is the continuous wave detector, which has 20 gigabytes of memory in the form of disk arrays, inexpensive disks. This little piece over here is a pulse detector. The pulse detection job is relatively easy. And this is an RFIF down converter to take the receive radio frequencies and put them down at a wavelength that we can actually analyze the frequency. So that's four racks of equipment. Let me show you another four racks of equipment. The racks stay the same size over the years. This is 30 years old. This is Frank Drake's first Project OSMA SETI experiment in 1960. Four racks of equipment in 1960. Four racks of equipment in 1994. Between those two four racks of equipment, there is an increase in 14 orders of magnitude, 100 trillion times increase in the compute capability that we can do with the same volume of hardware. So that's what the digital signal processing revolution has provided us. And some people say, well, you can do 100 trillion times better than you could 30 years ago. Why don't you wait a few years? You can do it even better next year and better the year after that. And that's quite true. What we can do every day gets better. Moore's law says processing capability doubles approximately every 18 months. It's been going like that for decades. Problem is that the same technology that enables this digital signal processing is exactly the same technology that's closing the microwave window with microwave interference. So there is a temporal necessity and urgency to this project to get on with it if we want to do it from the surface of the Earth. We may, in fact, be forced to look in the future at going to the lunar far side and letting the entire body of the moon act as a shield to keep out the radio noise from Earth. Now, the racks that we have usually don't reside in the lab. They usually reside in a large portable tractor trailer ensemble. They have to be portable in order to take them to all those telescopes that I pointed out around the world. There's another interesting thing about this trailer. We've lined it with 3/4 of an inch of steel and made it a Faraday cage so that the digital signal processing noise that we generate ourselves stays inside and we don't hear our own noise. And we know how efficacious that is and how important that is because occasionally we have to open the door and go inside and then all hell breaks loose. I mean, it's really a noisy environment. It was a good solution to put it all in its own steel box. This processors that we've built and that we take around the world are essentially a special purpose supercomputer with a continuous processing speed of 75 gigaflops. So it's quite fast. We loaded up that trailer in California last December. We put it on a boat. When we were in NASA, we flew. We flew on military aircraft, C-141s and that sort of thing. But now that we're private enterprise, we have to watch our funding very carefully. It came on a boat, and so we put it on the ship in Oakland, Port of Oakland in California, and a month later we greeted it in Sydney and breathed a sigh of relief that it made the journey intact. We parked it here at the base of the telescope at Parkes, and on the 2nd of February, we put our banner up on the tower and symbolically claimed the radio telescope for the following 16 weeks. The CSIRO were sufficiently pleased to be cooperating with us on this project that on the 2nd of February, they threw a party for us. And they brought in dignitaries such as Robin Williams, and we had nice speeches and had a good time. And I like to show this picture. I'm not sure. I think Ron Akers and I got married that day. I'm really not sure what this cake was all about. It was, however, a fun time, and it served to launch the Southern Hemisphere search in fine style. On that day, we raised the flag of Earth to the aerial cabin of the Parkes telescope, and we began our search starting with Alpha Centauri, the closest star to our sun. Inside the tower, we've got what is now, was then four, and is now a 5-screen video game that we play 24 hours a day. This is the kind of thing that it takes to keep track of the computations that are going on at Parkes. This workstation is used to keep track of the remote site at MOPRA and make sure things are working there. This is a screen that allows us to submit a series of observations, go look at this star at these frequencies for the following amounts of time. And once I start you going, don't bother me anymore, just tell me if something goes wrong. This is a screen that we use for editing the results, looking at candidates that are reported back by this by the system. And this screen is one that shows 1/30,000th of our view of the frequency time domain that's within this system. If we wanted to look at all the information that we were processing, we'd need 30,000 screens like this. Mm-hmm. But we use one, and we dedicate one single 1 hertz channel out of our 28 million to a test tone that we insert at the front end of the feed horn, and we ascertain that we see it all the way through our test equipment and our receivers. So that's our check that things are working. Now, I think it's obvious to most people, because I mentioned the fact that the sun is such a poor radio transmitter, that radio astronomy is done 24 hours a day. So this silicon-based intelligence is working continuously 24 hours a day with one human monitoring what's going on. The staff at at the Parkes Telescope and at MABRA have been tremendously supportive and have been very helpful to us as we've tried to get these two telescopes working together in a way that's never happened before. But they did have one complaint. We hauled in all of these workstations and all of the networks and things that go along with them, and somehow they said, gee, with such a big project, they were expecting a little more class, like maybe a crystal chandelier for the control room or something like that. So we listen. We're good listeners. So we went down to Parkes and found a brass hat rack, which now resides in the control room. It's our contribution to classing up Parkes Radio Observatory. Since we started on the 2nd of February, and until I left the telescope 3 days ago, this is the completion rate of the observations. Here are 209 stellar targets, and here's the frequency range from 1,200 to 3,000 megahertz, essentially 1 to 3 gigahertz that we had set out to search with our equipment. And here's S-band. It's the first segment of the feed horn that we used. We got about 70% completion in terms of, which wasn't bad considering that we were starting up the two telescopes from scratch. And we had some problems with our own equipment manufacturer and a radical new design that we tried that came in late in terms of our digital signal processing equipment. And then just last week, we've now changed to the lower frequency L band and will, in fact, by the 6th of June, I think, fill that in rather completely. It's a good thing we started at S-band and it wasn't an accident. You can see that there's some frequencies missing here consistently. Well, that's because there's a spacecraft up there that NASA has launched called TDRS, and it's just so loud that instead of the nice frequency time plane, which is mostly noise plus a signal, in this case, the Pioneer 10 spacecraft, which is out beyond the edge of the solar system, which we use every day to make sure our equipment is in fact working. Instead of this kind of a thing, which is what we optimized our equipment to detect, we find this. Basically, the spacecraft is just so noisy that we can't look through it. So this is a closed window. We lost 20 megahertz of the spectrum to that one spacecraft. At L-band, we'll probably lose somewhat over 100 megahertz of the spectrum, which is too full of spacecraft transmission here, 1530 to 1630. We just can't look through it. And in fact, this is a problem not just for SETI, but for all of radio astronomy and remote sensing, the passive users of the spectrum, that our own technology is making our view of the universe extraordinarily dark and cloudy. We found, in addition to the fiducials that the distant spacecraft, such as the Pioneer and Galileo, provide, we found some interesting signals on the sky. One night, we found the Big Zipper. I don't know whether that's as funny down south, because you call the constellation the saucepan down here. But in the north, it's the Big Dipper, and this night we found the Big Zipper. This is a spacecraft called Geotail. It's a Japanese-American spacecraft which every 3 hours and 15 minutes has an orbit that takes it from close to the Earth out beyond the moon and back. It's mapping the plasma tail of the Earth. And occasionally expects to lock up to a transmitted beam to get new instructions. And here, it's frantically seeking its oscillator. It's the signal that it's trying to lock up to, so it's moving very rapidly back and forth in frequency. This kind of thing shows us that indeed our equipment is working, and we understand very well why the interferometer responded to this kind of signal. Two nights before I left the telescope, we did find a signal that to date most closely matches what we had hoped we would be finding coming from a distant star at 1209 megahertz. This signal caused both telescopes to react very strongly and to give us a very good candidate identification. And again, it turns out that we learned a lot from what's up there in the sky. There is a great circle on the sky where a two-element interferometer will have a zero fringe rate between it. That is, a signal found at one telescope should be found at the other telescope at exactly the same frequency. There's no frequency offset. That frequency offset is what we're using as a discriminant against our own technologies. This, unfortunately, we happened to be pointing at a direction in the sky which lay on that arc where there was zero frequency separation, and this satellite signal came in the sidebands of both telescopes. So, again, a learning experience. This one was pretty exciting for a little while. For 5 minutes, it was pretty exciting. And we tend to be pretty skeptical. I mean, for a signal to be believable by us, it's going to have to pass a lot of filters and thresholds. And then, as soon as it does, we'll tell all of you, because it's not our intention to keep anything a secret. I'd just like to close by showing you something that a couple of years ago, when we first came to Australia to do site surveys to see whether, in fact, the environment was the interference environment was benign enough for us to consider this project down here. We got very excited when we got off the plane and changed our first money. Because on the back of your $50 bill, you have both the Parkes radio telescope and a DNA molecule. And we thought maybe that this would be quite prophetic, and we hope that it might still prove that to be the case before the 6th of June. As a last closing statement, I'll talk about what if. What if we detect a signal? Well, if we detect a signal, it's either of technological origin, the kind of thing we were looking for. It could be an astrophysical phenomena that we didn't expect. Or it could be something that was ambiguous, clearly real, clearly continuing, but we can't explain it. And in any of those events, we will make a full and public disclosure, and we will let the discovery data that's archived be analyzed by anyone who wants to look at it. And then what we do is really dependent on the nature of the signal and if there's any information content. If we don't detect a signal with Phoenix here in Australia, or at Arecibo or Greenbank or Nansei over the next decade, we will continue to always try and improve the technology of our searching. We'll have to make a decision about how we increase sensitivity, because that would be the next step. Do we build dedicated arrays? Do we look for ways? I mean, some of my colleagues are a little bit distressed to be here in Australia for 6 months away from their family, and they'd much rather that I please transmit the information from the telescope to their office rather than taking them from their office to the telescope. So we'll look at ways to do that in the future. And we'll consider perhaps different wavelengths or different signatures of technology as we go forward in time. Again, I'm hopeful that before the 6th of June, maybe I'll get a chance to come back and tell you that we've had a success. But I can't promise anything. All we can do is the best job that we know how. Thank you.